It's so comforting to hear people's maxims for life. For many of us, they're pretty simple. Something like, be kind, or go high when they go low. I like that one. But my guest today has some particular rules which actually mean he's able to stay alive every day at work. Richard Fitzpatrick's personal rules include, always stay away from the pointy end of a shark. Can't argue with that. Never make rash decisions after a near-death experience. And the animals will only show up and perform when you have given up all hope. You can't pretend to have given up all hope. You actually have to have given up. Now, Richard is an underwater cameraman and marine biologist and the man they call the shark tracker. I met him yesterday and asked him to take me to that moment at the age of 7 when he first plunged into the green iridescent waters of the Great Barrier Reef when his uncle Terry took him out snorkelling off Rockhampton.
Still to this day, I remember the first time when the bubbles cleared, just seeing all the staghorn coral, but the thing that really struck me were the electric blue little damselfish. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I'll never leave my mind. And, yeah, I have to thank Uncle Terry for getting me into this world that I live in now.
Yeah, right. So there's fish darting around. There's brilliant coral down there. I mean, kids these days go, oh, yeah, what made you get hooked?
Oh, it's just the unknown. Like every time you stick your head under the water, it's like, you know, looking at a TV soap opera. If you sit and wait long enough, you see life and death happening. The animals are trying to make their day-to-day living. You know, it's not just the big animals that's what I've been interested in. It's all the aspects of the reef. And when you sit and watch and you see the day-to-day life, you can even see things like humour down there. And it's just amazing that when you're in the underwater environment, it's a very close thing to you. Like if you were making a documentary in the Serengeti, you know, you've got a big long lens and it's hundreds of meters away.
Hopefully.
Whereas underwater, if you get 10 meters visibility on the day, you know, you're lucky. And so everything has to be close. It's very intimate. Often you have to establish relationships with the different animals. So then they go about their day-to-day business ignoring you after a period of time.
And so what's funny?
Well, just how the animals interact and chasing each other around and, you know, just I've seen fish come up and kissing each other. One memorable time was when I spent an entire day with this big trigger fish making this nest, and the nest is about 3 meters wide and they're renowned for being really, really aggressive. You know, if you go near the nest, they'll attack. So I spent a whole day with this one female trigger fish and then she let me into the nest and I was literally ended up being inches from the eggs while she was taking care of them. But the crater adjacent to me was another female. And every now and then, if my fin got too close to her nest, she'd gently come up, grab the tip of my fin and just move my leg out of the way. You know, it was just hilarious to see.
Like some sort of woman at the theatre saying, just step this way.
Yeah, just move to the side,
move
please.
Most kids collect stamps or Pokemon cards or whatever they collect these days. You started collecting fish. What sort of fish?
Oh, being a boy, you know, I was really interested in the dangerous stuff. So we had stonefish and lionfish and eels and, you know, small sharks called epaulette sharks. So I remember in year 8, I actually took a shark, a live shark, to school in an esky full of salt water, gave my first shark talk and, you know, mum dropped it back in the tank.
But so one day, mum knew. Careful of the stonefish, mum, when you put the shark back in the tank after
It was all good, but the one thing she drew the line at was one day when she opened the door and was confronted by a moray eel on the floor that had got out of the tank and it was like, yeah, no more morays.
Richard, come here.
That's right.
You'd take regular trips in your teenage years to a place called Northwest Island. Tell us about that. It's a kind of jewel, isn't it?
Oh, Northwest is amazing. So it's like an overnight boat trip. So we used to go out as a group of friends and, you know, two of them, one of them's now the preeminent deep water biologist for the Japanese government, even though he's from Rockhampton. And Bevan Slattery is one of Australia's biggest IT entrepreneurs, is now my business partner. So we all still work close together. But as teenagers, we'd go to Northwest and we'd go camping for 10 days or up to 2 weeks and we'd snorkel all day collecting fish and we'd be drawing pictures of them and all that kind of stuff and bring them back. Then we'd bring them back to our aquariums and, like, it's just an amazing way to grow up, is, you know, to learn about these animals. And when we were kids, you know, we're just snorkeling, but to catch a fish, you had to watch its behavior for hours, try and work out where it was going to go. And we used to do tag teams down with our little nets trying to catch the fish and then bring them back and observe them in our aquarium. So, but Northwest, you know, it's covered in Pisonia trees, and you get turtles nesting during the summer months and all the seabirds, just, yeah, an absolute jewel in the crown.
Mm. The extraordinary parents you had. How old were you when they let three boys go in a dinghy overnight and then spend a couple of weeks by themselves on a deserted island?
Oh, actually, one of the parents was a high school science teacher, so he used to take us and supervise us. But
fantastic.
I mean, we just head off at sunrise on just swimming out, and we had this old surf ski with nets and buckets hanging off it, and we'd spend the whole day out there and just paddle back in at sunset. And it's pretty hard to imagine kids being allowed to do that these days. But we used to be all day out in the water just snorkeling and playing with the animals. And, yeah, because we're always looking for the dangerous ones, because that's what was cool at that time.
So your parents, I read, reckoned this was just a phase, but and they weren't quite right about that, were they?
No, it kind of became an obsession. Sometimes I think maybe I should have listened to my mother about what they wanted me to do.
What, you wanted to be an accountant or something?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, Dad was an insurance, so it was pretty... Yeah, Mum and Dad weren't that into the ocean. It was, you know, really my uncle that got me into it. And then the group of friends I established, we all had that passion. And, you know, Dougal's dad, being a science teacher, loved all that kind of stuff. So we were forever, you know, and the weather was good out in boats, collecting and just, you know, learning about the environment. Mm. So that was a natural progression to become a marine biologist. And so Dougal became one and I became one, and, yeah, it just went on, so...
There was a bit of a detour along the way, Richard. In your last years of high school, your family moved to Adelaide. I mean, you were having this idyllic far north Queensland childhood. How did you react to that?
Well, I had to start diving in cold water. So let's just get a thicker wetsuit. And, the southern waters of Australia are spectacular. And so it opened my whole, you know, world up to the cold water environments. And, you know, I've done a lot of diving, not only in South Australia, but, you know, in Sydney, the harbour here is just amazing. I was at Manly Aquarium for many years working there. And everywhere you go, there's always something special. And the cold water environments are great. It's just you've got to put on a bigger wetsuit and a lot more lead weight belts.
It's not as much fun to get into in middle age too, as I recall.
Yeah, especially when it's cold. So, yeah, it's like, ugh.
You did get into trouble off the coast there of South Australia with scuba diving, didn't you? What happened?
Yeah, I had a few minor incidents. One, when I was snorkeling, I had a reverse squeeze from hell, which was basically my sinuses blocked up whilst I was underwater. So as I came up, the pressure wouldn't relieve. And so I was only free diving, and basically I couldn't get to the surface because of the pain. And my last conscious thought was drop the weight belt. Hopefully they'll find the body on the surface and take care of me. So it literally ruptured part of my skull down to my jawbone when the skull basically blew out.
And was this because you'd gone down too far and there was a problem with pressure in your skull?
I didn't know it at the time, but I actually had polyps in my sinus cavity, and I was diving with a bit of a flu, and they wedged into the eustachian tube, so there was no way for the pressure to get released except for cracking the skull.
You obviously survived it.
Oh, yeah, that was that. And then, you know, a year later, I was on a really deep dive. We had problems down there, and I ended up getting decompression sickness when I was about 16. So I had a few treatments and quite a few hours in a recompression chamber. So I kind of got all that stuff out of the way early in my career, and, you know, so.
Did all the worst things.
Oh, yeah, knock it off fast, yeah. But, yeah, I've done, like, over 15,000 hours underwater now. And, you know, you spend that time, you know, being bitten and stung by a lot of things. But it's just part of the job, really.
Now, as you say, you're a qualified marine biologist, and then you got interested in cinematography. And that was at the beginning of the video revolution. When did you start, or where did you start your underwater filming?
I was working at the aquarium in Townsville. And because I was always interested in behaviour, at that time people were just taking photographs and slides, and everyone, there were some amazing, you know, photographers out there like Ron and Val Taylor and all that, who I ended up being able to work with. But I was really interested in capturing behaviour, and so the video cameras were just coming out. And that was a great way for me to, you know, capture those moments and show people. And when I moved to Sydney to Manly Aquarium, we ended up almost making weekly segments for Totally Wild, the kids show. And this, I just got into filming. And then Ron and Val asked me on a few jobs and, you know, do this, do that. And then I developed a really bad camera habit. and they just kept getting bigger and bigger. So, yeah, I ended up, so I kind of live a hybrid life now where it's, you know, science on sharks and filming. So, yeah, spend a lot of time out there making documentaries. But at the same time, because, you know, science funding in Australia is so hard, we actually, whilst we're out on boats, we use that access to allow us to get research done. So we'll often be running concurrent research programs while we're filming. And that works really well because it gives us new stories to film. So like in the recent Attenborough Great Barrier Reef series, they had a list of animals that they wanted
to... Hang on, you work with David Attenborough?
Yeah, so I shot most of the recent Great Barrier Reef series that was on ABC a few weeks ago.
You're joking, say that again. You shot most of that?
Yeah. I didn't do the parts of David. I do all the animal stuff. So
you don't get distracted when he says, Richard, I want you to film that fish over there for me. And you think, gosh, I wouldn't be able to do anything.
There was a few discussions during the making of it. He was only here for 10 days and then I went for like 9 months pretty well out by myself filming. But there's a few things where there's one sequence. He had it in his mind about these mantis shrimp. He had heard about that there's an elaborate courtship with these mantis shrimp. We spent weeks and weeks trying to do it. And
bloody mantis
shrimp. We sort of had to tell him that we couldn't see any courtship by the males. Like, these are Australian mantis shrimp and, like, the males didn't really care about the courtship. And so, yeah,
mate, what you got to understand, here in Australia,
you're
heterosexual shrimp.
That's right.
It's not going to do what think it's going to do. It's not nearly as dapper as you poms.
Not at all.
How'd he go with that?
Yeah, it's fine about it. But the hardest part, like we did tiger, I was doing tiger sharks and everything, but the hardest part of the shoot was filming a seahorse giving birth. So I spent 72 hours straight just sitting there waiting for the seahorse to give birth. And you only get about 5 minutes notice. It's all over in 30 seconds. And I was just shotgunning Red Bull and Pepsi and stuff, trying to stay awake. And it finally gave birth on the third day in the morning. So I don't know whether I was crying or laughing. I was just off my head that, you know, I finally got the shot. Because David, I'd shot a wide angle shot and he's like, oh, it would really be good to get a close up. And like the first one took days as well. And I'm like, oh, if I can fit it in. And I had to leave the next morning to go back to Rain Island to film turtles and tiger sharks. So as soon as I shot it about 6:30 in the morning, I ran up, put the data card in the computer. I was doing a backup and all that kind of stuff and you know, emailing it to the BBC. And I must have passed out. I flipped backwards in my chair, landed on the chair next to me, almost cracked my sternum, and I was just in so much pain. And so the hard, most dangerous part of the entire shoot wasn't tiger sharks. It was these bloody baby seahorses. So, and that the production officers of the BBC were just laughing over that one. They're like, oh, was anyone there to film it? I was like, no, it was by myself.
And what was it like working with the great man? He sounds, while he wasn't on the shoot, it sounds like he's very involved.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of script writing. And so during the edit process, there's a lot of to and fro because we were still filming, you know, and they go, oh, we want more of this, less of this and all that kind of stuff. I've done a few series. I did Life in Cold Blood and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, he has his own crew for him being shot and we're literally the monkeys who spend like 3 months waiting for something to happen.
You talk about sharks. You spend a lot of time with reef sharks and tiger sharks. When did your fascination with them start?
Again, as a young teenager, you know, when we were out snorkeling all the time, if we saw a shark, it was a great day, you know. And I remember our first tiger shark, we were just snorkeling and it wasn't a big one, but it actually, we had to split apart and it swam between the two, between me and Dougal. And that was just a magic moment. And so, my favourite are the tigers. You know, they're number two after the great white in terms of danger, but the great white gets all the attention. But with the tigers, you know, we don't use cages. You're out of the water with them. You can get really close to them. You learn individuals have different behaviours. But you've got to have the eyes in the back of your head because at some stage the tigers are like, I wonder what you taste like. And they'll come over and luckily, you know, that's when you get the good shots with the camera. You can just hold them at bay and then they're like, oh, okay, I'll go back to the, you know, the food, the turtle or something, what they're eating on. So you can actually... Literally, you're that close that you put your hand on the side of the shark to push back. They're an amazing animal. I do love the tigers. And that's the one I do most of my scientific research on as well. You know, we do a lot of satellite tagging of them, looking at the home range. This year we're doing a lot of metabolic rate research on them, actually putting cameras on the sharks. And, you know, the thing about sharks is that, you know, every time you're in the water with them, you actually come out with more questions. And it's that whole unknown, it's that whole discovery, it sort of keeps us driving, and we use the filmmaking to, you know, show the people the wonders of the sharks, but also to help fund, you know, all the new research we're trying to do.
You say that every shark has a different personality, and just like us, they have good days and bad days.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about the constipated grey nurse shark called Dave.
Dave, yeah. That's when I was working at Manly Aquarium, and there was the biologist down there, and the diver said, you know, Dave's looking a bit funny. He had a real hunchback, and there was a bit of a lump in his tummy. So I jumped in the tank to have a look, and he swam over me, and I just put my hand up and rubbed him along the belly. So this is a, you know, 3-metre grey nurse shark, and I could feel that it was a, you know, solid, solid lump inside. And as soon as I rubbed his belly, he just turned around and came back, and I did it again and again. And so he just kept coming back to get this tummy rub. And that night we had some tourists to take in the tank for a shark dive. And as soon as I hopped in the tank with these 10 tourists, Dave saddled up beside me. And I just put my arm over him and just rubbed his tummy for like the whole hour dive. And all these tourists are going, oh my God, this is, yeah, pretty bizarre. But the next morning we had an international photographer out had heard about it. And he goes, oh, I want to take photos of you and Dave. So I jumped in the tank and I saw one of the male sharks come around the corner, had a bit of a hunchback, and you know, just put my arm over it and rubbed the belly. And I was like, oh, it's gone. Oh, wrong shark. Bang, good big tail flick, and my mask came off and all that kind of stuff. And the photographer was laughing. And then Dave swam around the corner, still off the lump. And so I went up to him, massaged it. And after about an hour, he finally released this massive ball of like fish bones that had just, you know, bounded up inside him. And then he just straightened up and swam off and didn't want to know about me at all after that. You know, didn't ring, didn't write, you know, it was all over. And yeah, so that's how you deal with a constipated shark.
Now, my guest is Richard Fitzpatrick. His new book is Shark Tracker, Confessions of an Underwater Cameraman. I don't want to go too far down this path that sharks are such docile and lovable creatures, because you've been bitten on the bum. Tell us about Patches.
Yeah, that was the last day at work at Manly Aquarium, so I sort of wanted to go out with a bang. So it was a part of the tank where the tourists couldn't see you, so I was baiting the fish and one of the big snapper came in close enough, so I pushed it down the bucket and cut its throat with a knife that was down there to get a bit of fresh fish, because we always fed frozen fish to the sharks, but if you ever did fresh stuff, it got pretty exciting. And then I was walking along to the shark feeding spot, because we used to walk in the tank, and so I had the fish in tight next to me, and we always played practical jokes on people on their last day at work. And Adam, who was my dive buddy at the time, he was behind me, and I was walking along and just got smashed in the leg and the butt. And I thought it was, you know, like a hard hit from him, you know, just skylarking. And then I thought, oh, geez, he's got sharp fingernails. And I turned around and the whole bottom jaw of the shark was in my butt. And then I could hear this scream and I'm looking around, it wasn't me. And it was a tour guide in the tunnel. And so she had the microphone, all the tourists are watching. And so she was just screaming in the tunnel. I could actually hear it through the water. And then poor old Patches, we sort of had to push his snout off and he sort of swam off, and Adam came in to have a look and sort of gave me an, oh, don't know sign, and basically had a dead leg. So I had to hop around to the shark feed site and finish the shark feed, which resulted with another shark coming in from above that I didn't see from behind. And I saw the you know, well, everyone in the tunnel pointing. So I just dropped my head at the last moment as the jaws just snapped right behind my neck. So I was like, okay, get rid of the fish, get out of the tank.
Yeah, well, you are giving out a tantalising stream of blood gravy
exactly.
In the water.
So, you know, yeah, got my butt chewed out on my last day at work. And then I had to drive to Queensland. It was like a 2-day car trip. So they presented me with like a donut cushion.
You're sitting
at
on
my
a rubber
going
ring.
Away party.
Oh, they're very pleasant. I don't know who's more dangerous, the workmates or the sharks.
Oh, definitely the workmates.
Before I leave you, I mean, we've only got a minute left. Do you think sharks deserve that exalted position as the most feared sea creature? You know, we're very keen to put up shark nets to cull sharks and all the rest of it. What are your views on that?
Yeah, it's funny. When it comes to sharks, I don't know what it is. Sort of journalism just goes out the door, you know, just talking about shark, you know, frenzied waters and all this kind of stuff. It's not real, you know. The reality is when we make a shark doco, we spend a lot of time just sitting around and waiting. But, I mean, with what's happening at the moment, the best example I can compare it to is, you know, I'm from North Queensland. We live with the world's most venomous marine animal, the box jellyfish. And through really good science, we know when and where they occur. So then we came up with ways to manage people. You can't manage the animals. You have to manage people.
So you don't get in the water at certain times
exactly.
of year.
Exactly. You've got stinger nets, you've got suits, we've got surf lifesavers who do daily patrols, and if they do find a box jellyfish, that beach and the one to the north and south are shut down for that day. So we really need science to know when and where. And so then we can manage people. You can tell people if it's a high-risk time or to come up with techniques to better protect them. So science will ultimately help that problem. Throwing out 1950s technology like indiscriminate netting and all that kind of stuff, that's just crazy. You know, it's not going to solve the issue.
But if you can't stop a 17-year-old Richard Fitzpatrick taking risk-taking behaviour, you're not going to stop a kid at Newcastle or a kid off the south coast of Western Australia going out in the middle of winter early in the morning with a surfboard. Is there anything else other than culling and netting that you think works?
Well, there's some really amazing barrier technology coming out of South Africa, which are the world's leaders in shark control and protection and also research. And it's all based around their research where they've been developing these techniques. End of the day, the best shark repellent is common sense. And like if you're in the winter months, again, you know, maybe not doing the surf when it's really dark in the morning, maybe start work earlier, take a few hours off at lunch and fit it in the surf then. You know, just know what the risks are. But yeah, the best shark repellent is the brain. It's common sense to avoid the high risk times. And science will tell us when those times are.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in. While we listen to the next program, I want the listener to imagine this may happen or it may not, that you've just quickly dropped your dacks and shown me the shark bite on your bum.
Yeah.
We'll leave them with that okay. image, hey? Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.